The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and this is Carolyn Yeager, and welcome to another Saturday afternoon with me. This is April 27th, 2013. This year has moved along, quite fast, and now we're going into May, and then June is always, for me, the best month, and then it goes, we start going toward the end of the year, and that's always a little more on the depressing side for me, because another year will be gone. Oh boy. Anyway, I'm glad that I have some listeners. Hope I get some more. And today I did not send an announcement out for today's show or a mailer, because we didn't have it prepared. But I have been working hard at it, and I think I have some interesting stuff to say, and I'm going to be very open and frank today, because I have to be in order to keep going and talk for 2 hours. So sometimes that's the best, and it feels pretty good to me when I do it. So I'm just going to be saying what I think about a number of issues. One of them that I'm going to start with is the Boston bombing affair at the Boston Marathon. I haven't said anything about that, and it's not that I have a lot to say, or that I just looked at the general stuff. Of course, I followed Tan Stoffel's blog, and he wrote about it quite a bit. And I, saw all the news, and I read as much as I could, but I didn't really get into this, to the ideas that it's a media fakery along the same lines that people consider so much of 9/11 and Sandy Hook to be media fakery. And I got very involved in Sandy Hook, and I made it clear that after studying it enough, I didn't believe a whole lot of what the media said. And I thought it was very, very clear that they were putting something, that they had created something and had not done a very good job of it. And this is the thing that is kind of a big question. Why did they make it so obvious when things that the story they're giving is not really believable? However, it could be seen that they're doing the best they can in the sense of how they go about it and how many people know about it and who's behind it and so on. And at the same time, they know that the people won't believe other than what the media tells them, particularly if it comes to what is considered to be big government conspiracies. So, our government working against us in really serious ways, like killing and murdering its own citizens in order to make political advancement for its causes. People have a real hard time with this. So it seems to remain, all this speculation seems to remain in the area of the people who are not in the mainstream at all, in the alternative media, and even there it becomes controversial. But I have to say that after what I spent last night going over all the pages at Clues Forum on this Boston bombing, and I did that because I found that I can't read everything, but Clues Forum is a good place to go to and see just about everything that's been brought forth in the way of fakery and conspiracy and so on these subjects, if it's a subject like this that they cover. So while I'm not I'm not saying, oh, I just believe everything that's on Clues Forum, or I think they're the greatest people. I've got some things to comment about that. But I did that because it's a place where I know I can get a really good overview of what the alternative theories are. And, of course, I was aware of a lot of this before I did that last night, but I wanted to see if I missed anything, you know, if I needed things that had come up and if there's any newer things. Well, I'll tell you, what has impressed me the most, somebody's calling. I appreciate your call. I didn't say at the beginning that I can't take calls in the first hour. Actually, I can take them, but it messes up the programming for me, and I don't get my prompts at the break time and so on, and that can be a problem for me. So we just have a rule here, no calls in the first hour, but I do welcome you to call after the break in our second hour. There is a second hour here. And we can bring up any of these things. In fact, I hope people do call because I will have time. I've got something I can if after I get done with all my chatting about various subjects, I've got something really good that I can read if need be. But I don't need to read it. I can, you know, so I can talk with callers. So thank you, caller. He hung up. What got me, what impressed me the most on this, on what I saw on Clues Forum, and of course I had seen this before, but it's very strange, is this Jeff Bauman, who lost his legs, allegedly, in this bombing, and this is the kind of thing that, you know, causes people to be just totally horrified and angry if you would tell them that this is a hoax. I mean, what about that guy? All his suffering. Ah, can you say that? So, unlike, you know, they make the point that unlike the Sandy Hook, where they didn't want to show you anything, they tried to show you a whole lot here. And I'm not saying that, I am not saying that I know that it didn't happen. I'm saying that my inner truth meter, and I think I have a good one, is just very, just doesn't, you know, finds these questions more convincing than the story that we're given. So this Jeff Bauman, they make a lot of this that this, you know, he's really, well, how do you explain that somebody who, when you see pictures like this, you see these photographs, and then they show you his whole legs there, blown off below the knee and this bone sticking out. I must have seen that picture, I don't know how many times, 25 times or something, going through this forum. And I'd seen it before, but I hadn't seen it all the way down to the bottom before. And I wondered why, what it looked like, but, It's horrifying. It's amazing. It's unbelievable. Well, then they have pictures of him laying there. This whole, right after the bomb went off, this crowd of people laying around there, and you know, in shock and so on. And then some what you call first responders show up, and they're looking around there, and you see this Jeff Bauman. You see him there, he's very recognizable. In all the photos, once you have gotten used to what he looks like, he wears a gray jacket that has a hood, but it's not up, and he's got this brownish, real curly hair. I'd call it kinky, but it looks very curly. And the thing is that later there's pictures shown of him where he doesn't have curly hair at all. So, and it doesn't look like this same person either. So this was kind of interesting to me, because I then even was able to entertain the idea that this was a different person in these scenes that they show you of the bombing, and this person Jeff Bauman, who you see in a hospital bed smiling, looking happy, you know, all these amputee victims from this event, they show them just, you know, days afterwards, or maybe it's more than that, maybe it's a week or 2 weeks, but just so upbeat, so happy. Other people have commented on this, but it's true. And I don't think, I don't know. I guess you can have a kind of a response immediately, you know, shortly after, where you get a lot of media attention and it seems like a big deal, and you're kind of picked up by it all, and you still haven't taken it all in, maybe, although when you look at that leg, looks like a, you know, a bandaged up stump. I don't know how, but I know that I would be unhappy about it, and I don't know whether I would be wanting to smile and talk so boldly to cameras. But people do behave strangely when they get in front of cameras. So, you know, that is something to take into account. But still, there's the question of whether, you know, whether these are the same people. And in these pictures, this bomber is laying there amongst these other people. And his legs are blown off with, you know, they're gone. And he's got these bones sticking out of one of them. And all these first responders are not dealing with him. They're looking at others. They're, you know, there's a few of them there. There are two women who look like maybe they might be dead. One of them's eyes is open, but that doesn't mean anything. And this woman, this first responder female, is checking the pulse in their necks. And someone is with someone else. But here, nobody is looking at this guy. And there's some other photographs that show right at the time of the explosion that he's kind of in this bundle with two other people, and he's underneath, and this Negro woman is kind of leaning over his body, you know, laying there too, sitting up a little bit, and then there's another man behind her. They all look very like they're very close together. Of course, you've got this perspective in these photographs, but and eventually, they show you different frames. It all happened very fast, I'm sure, in this series of frames. But you don't know what's going on, but eventually he sticks his legs up in the air, and you see that bone sticking out. And you know that's the one. And some people are saying that these other two people were helping to create this effect. Well, I don't. You know, I do have a real problem with how you create an effect like that. You can't crunch the person's legs up, you know, into the thigh. I don't think so, when the thigh looks pretty normal, and then have this thing on as a kind of a, you know, special effects like they do in movies, you know, which they can do on. So supposedly that's what was happening, or the only thing I could come up with was that this person who was the who lost his legs, that they called Jeff, was already without his legs. He was already an amputee. We have a lot of amputees from the military. And there's some interesting information about that, about how when your leg is blown off, it just takes one, you know, you cut these arteries, that big main arteries down the leg, and you bleed very, very fast. And unless a tourniquet is applied very fast, you know, you're going to bleed to death, and you're also going to be unconscious and so on. But this guy seems like he was never unconscious, and maybe in that one photograph, right, but that was right when it was happening. So right when the bomb was going off, that guy sitting, who was kind of a little in front of him, or would be behind him as you look at the picture, would not be putting a tourniquet on. And when he lifts his leg up, you don't see any tourniquet on the thigh. So you know, and you don't see blood running down all over the place either. It's very, very strange. So that's the only thing I can think of, is that he was already an amputee, and he was part of this group of actors, and he either went out with that disguise on. This is terrible. This is why people who aren't into this kind of thing just get furious if they hear somebody talking like I'm talking, you know, and not being, you know, properly showing the proper deference to the suffering. But, you know, I've gotten used to that, dealing with the things I deal with. So or that when that was happening, they were putting that on him, you know, doing whatever they needed to do to him. But then they show him, as everybody knows, with being transported in this wheelchair by this strange mestizo guy or Spanish guy or Hispanic guy who's there helping out. They've looked into him a lot, too. But, you know, I mean, there's no proof. Well, here's the proof. Here's how he's sitting up. He's conscious. He's awake. His legs are, you know, are sticking out there, you know, with all that, only the bones sticking out and nothing much left under the knees. Incredible photographs. And I thought the first time I ever saw it, how can this guy be sitting in this wheelchair and be conscious? His eyes are open. He looks intelligent. He doesn't look like he's in a daze. He doesn't look like he's in such shock that he doesn't know what's going on. I'm sure if you can see it as truthful that he was in shock. But every people who know something about things like this, you know, medics and people who've studied it and researched it, say it's just impossible. And why they did that way, I don't know. Again, you have to ask, why was, if this is all fake, why did they do these crazy things? And then there's a lot of photoshopping. But now another thing that is convincing to me, besides this Jeff Bauman, is this situation that they have more and more, where we're finding out more and more organizations that deal with training actors and people to participate in these disaster drills. And they advertise it. I mean, they do it. It's going on. And here again, once again, there was a disaster drill taking place somewhere in Boston. I think I'm right about this. I didn't actually look this all up or anything, this part of it. But it's been said there was a disaster drill going on that day or the day before somewhere in Boston. And when people describe how this scenario could occur and they could get all these actors there, and these actors believe that they are participating in a drill to help, you know, teach people and so on, and they train them as actors so that they will be as realistic as possible. So you say, well, you know, there's nobody giggling or nobody, but once in a while you see people looking kind of bored. And you see people, even the police who are around, not doing much of anything, you know, not seeming to be frantic like they should be. A lot of people aren't frantic. Even the victims aren't very frantic once in a while, but they do it. They keep talking when we look up these schools for actors for this, of how realistic they are able to be. They don't just provide the actors. I guess they can provide even more. You know, whole situations, they direct it and everything. But that fits. And I talked about that when I was talking about Sandy Hook. And it seemed very believable to me. And it seems even more believable now that this is what's going on. And, you know, I thought, I don't know, I haven't. Like I say, I'm a novice at this, but I thought last night that they could have this business going on it at another location that looked like this location, or they could put the background in. Here's they have this blue screen, green screen, blah blah. They can put the people in the foreground. They can put in a different background, so they could have been doing this somewhere else in a drill, making it as realistic as possible. And people do comment that the blood that was on the pavement there looked awfully strangely red, bright red, and there was no blood spurting out of people, and people weren't that bloody, but they had it on the sidewalk. But then they could put this, they could put all this with a different background at the Boston Marathon, and they could have put off a, you know, a smoky bomb thing at the Boston Marathon, and then on television show these pictures, you know, instead of what they had there, because you don't see anything for a while, just the smoke, and then as it clears up, you start seeing close-ups of these people that were supposedly victims. And they put all this on television, and they're all coordinated, and then people cannot bring themselves not to believe it. They can't bring themselves to question it when you show victims. With those kids at Sandy Hook, those little kids, I don't think they needed to show them, because they just talked about first graders, second graders, you know, in this classroom in school, and that was enough to just, you know, wow people and make people totally pass, you know, unwilling to question it. And they, teachers and all this stuff. Now here, though, they had to show more, so they went all out. But it's, well, it can all be done. And then you learn about how they've been doing this since World War II, and probably a little bit before, but they really got good at it during and after World War II, and they've been working on it all this time. So I'm pretty convinced that this is what's going on. And it's what it should bring to all of us is what it brings to me is that it is so incredible that that we need to recognize, or I'm recognizing, I have for some time, but it gets worse and worse, that nothing that I see in the way of, you know, things from television or movies or photographs of supposedly actual events and so on can be trusted. I mean, we can't trust this stuff. There's nothing, you can't trust what you read, not what they write, and you can't trust what you see either. And this becomes a world which is really unbearable. This is unbearable to live amongst this stuff. I mean, you can refuse to believe it, as I do, but it doesn't make it any, well, it doesn't make it, I don't know what it makes it, but I would say that it doesn't feel like it makes it any better living in it, because I still have to live in it, and I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker of it. And maybe they think that they'll make people like me and people who catch on so sick that we'll commit suicide or something. We won't have kids. We won't do it. We just can't stand this world anymore. And pretty soon there won't be any of us. And there'll just be all those people who can't bring themselves to question. In the meantime, they'll get better and better at it. So it's quite, I won't go into any more details about that, because there's other people who could do it better. But I was going to say a few things about Clues Forum. I get a lot from there when I go there. Maybe I'm being brainwashed there. I don't know. But I will say that there's somebody there who I have decided is a Jew and might be there as a kind of a gatekeeper. Because one thing they don't do at Clues Forum is ever go after Jews. And the person behind it is this Shaq. Now all of a sudden I've forgotten his first name, but I'm sure I've got it here. Simon Shaq. Simon Shaq, who is the person who upset the 9/11 truth movement with his media fakery theories and his no planes theory. And I have, you know, friends and people I admire who are really, really down on that. And I've gone along with it, although I didn't, when it got to that part, when it got to that point, I was no longer focusing on 9/11 truth, and I was on to Germany and Holocaust, and so World War II interested me much more. So that's where I never took that in. But I do like what Simon is doing on this forum of his, which really started from his movie that he made about 9/11 fakery, and he has a lot of followers. But there's this fellow there who seems to be almost one of his right hand men, who's maybe been there from the beginning. Nay, he calls himself Brian V. All one word, Brian V. And I noticed him earlier, and now here again, he is protecting Jews and Jewish interests. He has 2,554 posts, which is a lot. Most people you know, are in still under 1,000, and some of them are just under 100. You know, new people come along and they do good work. You know, they put up good stuff. So you don't have to have that many to be good at what you're doing. But he acts like the expert, and he also, I noticed, aggressively criticizes others, particularly newer ones, if he thinks that what they're posting does not accept what the ideas at Clues Forum are, does not accept the TV fakery. If there's any hint of question about it, you know, like, well, I'm not convinced yet, but I'm interested in this. Well, then he jumps on them. Like they shouldn't say that, and are they saying that in order to undermine what's being done there on that forum? And he gets away with it because he's been there, you know, he's been there all this time, and I guess a friend of Simon's. I don't know if Simon is a Jew. I don't think so. I never hunted for it. And I don't know who this Brian B. I wouldn't know how to look him up because I don't know his name. But he, in the Sandy Hook thing, after I had a couple programs, and somebody on there was commenting, I think it might have been Simon, who posted the link to maybe the first show with Martin. If I had thought about talking about this today, I would have gotten hold of Martin and seen if he would have come on. But I didn't come up with this until last night. So, you know, it's too late to ask somebody to come on as a guest. Nobody wants to come on in a moment's notice. So I didn't. But maybe another time we will do that. I wasn't sure what my own feelings were about it until I spent some time looking at it last night. So, anyway, when Simon posted the link to the White Network program of mine with Martin and said some positive words, Brian came right on and said, oh, but, you know, if you look further there, they got this. They like Adolf Hitler, and they are. Then there's a Holocaust denial, and he was saying things like that, or showing one of those little faces of somebody throwing up. That's what he did. You know, they like to use those little round yellow faces there. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, I mean, he's one of those. Nobody else complained about that. Nobody mentioned that, only Brian. And that was the end of that. So then this time, though, on the Boston bombing, he did something again that caused me to think this. So it was Simon Schack actually had posted, or maybe somebody else had posted it, and then Simon commented on it, this picture of some responders pulling the stretcher of a woman who's has a very burned foot on one of her feet, and to an ambulance. And the guy in the front is a dead ringer for Steven Spielberg. He really is. In fact, when I saw it, I thought the same thing. Man, he looks like Steven Spielberg. Of course, I didn't think he was, but I'm not that silly. But right after that, somebody, I think it was a part of it, because it came from somewhere else and someone had written under it, please convince me that this is not Steven Spielberg. And it was kind of like a joke, you know. And then somebody on the Clues Forum wrote, something else that was supposed to be a joke. And then it was Simon. Simon wrote something that was supposed to be a joke. Well, then Brian shows up and says, so this is the same time. This is the same thing. Brian is responding to what Simon wrote. So I don't think Simon is a Jew, and Simon doesn't have any love for Jews. But this Brian... Now, oh, I had all this here. I didn't have to remember it. Brian said, that's rather a stretch of the imagination, isn't it, to call this guy, to, you know, say this guy looks like Steven Spielberg. And he says, Steven Spielberg is a man. The above thing which you point to, which you point at, is a cloud of pixels. So, you know, I thought, well, he cannot allow Steven Spielberg to be joked about as being in here, or even being a mythical figure, because they believe that all these things are fake, and so he says it that way. But he's needing to separate the great Jew. Obviously, he respects Steven Spielberg, or he wouldn't emphasize that Steven Spielberg is a man. And because Steven Spielberg is one of the great myth makers. So, you know, you could even think him to be a myth himself. But I think only a Jew would do that in both cases. And so there you've got on Clues form this very influential poster who is a Jew and is careful to keep anything about Jews away. And that's why he made those two comments. Now, I don't follow this thing. They've got all kinds of threads that I've never read. So I don't know where he may have done this elsewhere. I guess I could look him up. I just, you know, this just came to me last night. So at the very least, we've got Jews everywhere. No matter where you go, what you look at, there's going to be some Jew who has wormed his way into an influential position and is kind of in like Flynn, so to speak, you know, has a strong position and works to protect Jewry, because this forum has never gone after Jews for 9/11 that I know of or anything else. And this is why some people, you know, I mean, they don't talk about the Mossad. They don't do anything like that. They just talk about media, the media doing all this, which is okay because they are doing it. So any questions about that or comments can come in the second hour. And let me tell you now, for those who might be wondering, that number to call is 1-830-443-4911. That's after the break, please. Don't call during the break. Okay, now I'm going to go on to my next topic, which is the 20th anniversary of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum that is being celebrated this month. They opened in April 22nd, would have had to be 1993 for this to be the 20th anniversary. And, you know, the first thing that struck me, of course, every time I see anything about the Holocaust Museum in Washington, I get, you know, I'm instantly turned off and, you know, unreceptive mood. But this one, for one of the first things I thought was 20th anniversary. You know, why can't they wait for the 25th anniversary? Now, I can understand a 10th anniversary, and then after that, a 25th, but 15 years was too much for them to wait. Obviously, when they have an opportunity, they take all the opportunities they can get to talk about themselves and make a big fuss and get a lot of people that that are well-known to come and speak for them. And but I want to tell you a little bit about this one, what they're doing. Is it so... Well, you know, we need to look past, there needs to be more attention paid to things like this. And, you know, the revisionist community does not do its job. I'll get into that. I'll just go, what I've got, my notes here, I'll just go down so I don't get confused and forget things that I didn't say. So, you know, this is, what is this anniversary about? Okay, it's about... I already said what it was about. And they're having Elie Wiesel and Bill Clinton as their featured speakers on Monday in this big ceremony at the museum in Washington, D.C. And their theme for it is Never Again. Never Again, real original. But I just wanted to comment that this made me think, too, that why is it, you know, this museum is run by Jews, and everybody who's writing about this anniversary is Jewish, almost totally, that I could see. There's not a whole lot. It's just them, you know, promoting it for all they're worth, and some people picking it up. But you know, wherever you look, I think we should be aware of this, and you see people writing and getting published and printed. And on news shows and on television and in debates and so on, they're Jews. They're more and more. Everyone we see, everything that you have to read, unless you're staying away from everything mainstream and just sticking with our little alternative kind of groupings, they're all Jews. And then they're Jews in our groups too. Anyway, this, they call this, this offends me. I'm sorry, I'm having a little something in my throat. They're calling this a national tribute to Holocaust survivors and World War II veterans. Now, this offends me right here. National tribute. You see how they have taken on the cloak of being a national organization representing the nation. I talked about this recently on another thing about the museum, that because they have been mandated by Congress and they're in Washington, D.C., now they call themselves national as though to be representing the government, and the government, they don't really, but the government doesn't ever question them or say, oh, no, don't do that or anything. They would never do that. So they get away with it. So they're calling it, they're having a national tribute dinner and a national tribute day at the museum. And it's here's what it boils down to. The nation is offering tribute to Holocaust survivors. So what is it? United States of America, it's national, you know, as something in a national role, is offering tribute to Holocaust survivors and World War II veterans. And they're able to do this and get away with it. Of course, you know, how many people pay attention? But they get as many people to pay attention as they can. And they're going to have a dinner on Sunday. That's tomorrow. And then on Monday, Bill Clinton is going to join with Elie Wiesel, who is the founding chairman of the museum, to give addresses. And Clinton is going to give the keynote address. This scumbag, you know, and I think I used to like him. I didn't know how much I liked him, but I preferred him to the others. And I generally tended to believe him. Well, that was a long time ago. He dedicated the museum 20 years ago. So on their founding, he was there then in 1993. Yeah, okay, he was president then. So he had to. They all do it. That's why he was there. He was the president then. And in the 70s, 79, when they formed their planning commission for this museum and so on, it was Jimmy Carter. So you've got these two Democrats, but Republicans would probably do it too. I'm sure they would. So you've got, now let me move along here. What else upsets me is that, this really upsets me. Okay, this is good too. You know, the museum's highest honor now is something called the Elie Wiesel Award. And they only invented it. I talked about it the year they started it. Maybe it was 2 years ago. I think it was probably more than last year. But I even have an article about it at the Elie Wiesel Cons the World. But you know, I've made this point many, many times. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and Elie Wiesel are like, you know, cross your fingers. They are like, they are one. They are one in spirit and everything else. He was a part of getting that going, and they will never forget him, and they will promote his memory and his greatness and so on forever and ever as long as they exist. So, but this Elie Wiesel Award is this year going to be presented to Susan Eisenhower, granddaughter of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, on behalf of all World War II veterans and it's also going to be presented to another person, a Polish, Władysław Bartoszewski, on behalf of all those who rescued Jews during the Holocaust, and for his singular leadership of Polish-Jewish relations following World War II, blah, blah, blah. This is really bad. Now, I was happy to see this Susan Eisenhower thing because it just points out that, you know, how they feel that Dwight Eisenhower was a big friend of theirs, and of course he was, And so now old Susan is going to get, that's the daughter of his son and the Nixon girl, Julie Nixon. That's who that is. I don't know anything about her, but she'd just go along with it. So, now I want to tell you though about this Władysław Bartoszewski. I looked him up, and you know, his picture, if you look at his picture, he is so Jewish. He is so Jewish. And no question about it. Looks exactly like the most typical, Eastern European Jew. And he's got a big nose to go along with it. But he calls himself a Roman Catholic. Well, his family probably were pretending to be Roman Catholics. He says on his Wikipedia page, where he does not give any information about his birth or his parents' names or anything. That's always another, I've said this before, that's a giveaway that they are covering up their past. He's obviously born to Jews, and somewhere along the line, I don't even believe half of what's written on here. He says he went to Catholic schools in Poland. I already said that. Okay. And another thing about him is that even though he says he's Catholic, he's an honorary citizen of Israel. Israel made him an honorary citizen. And of course, he's just all his life been a big friend of the Jews. Now, another thing I found out about him was that in 2005, there's a picture of him in 2005 at the International Book Fair in Warsaw, Poland, where he's promoting his Polish language book, it has a Polish name, but it means in English, My Jerusalem, My Israel. Can you imagine this Roman Catholic who won't admit that he's a Jew, refuses to admit it, but he's selling this book to all the Jews, My Jerusalem, My Israel. Sickening. Now, here's his story. In September 1940, he was detained in Warsaw during a surprise roundup, they call it, of members of the public. Sure, they were just rounding up members of the public. They were rounding up resistance people involved in resistance, people they had reason to believe were working against the German presence and administration there and so on. But this is how they write this stuff. This whole page is full of lies. He was rounded up along with some 2,000 innocent civilians, among them Witold Pilecki. They're making a big deal out of this Pilecki guy also, who's also got a big fake story. And so I just, want to point out that Pilecki is not innocent, nor was Bartoszewski, or they wouldn't have been rounded up. So he was in Auschwitz concentration camp from September 22nd, 1940, until he was released in April 1941. So that's only, most of September is gone, so October, November, December, January, February, March, and not much of April. So 6.5 months, maybe, he was in Auschwitz. Because he was arrested for carrying on anti-German activities. And they gave him a sentence, and they probably tried to, give him some rehabilitation or somewhat, and he probably acted like he was taking to it. And he was released after maybe he had a 6-month sentence or something. Anyway, that has to be the story. He wasn't just thrown in there for no reason with all these other innocent people. So after his release, though, he contacted this Association of Armed Struggle, and he reported on his concentration camp imprisonment to the Information and Propaganda Bureau of the Home Army. That everybody should know what that the Polish Home Army were, the resistor people, and another version of this Association of Armed Struggle, that's what this group was. It's the largest resistance movement in Poland. So he was helping them, telling lies about what happened. He would have been. He was telling lies about what he experienced in Auschwitz. Now, he was in Auschwitz 1, where it really was a labor camp, a work camp, and work makes you free, where, you know, if you carry out your sentence, you get released. And it was all happening just like that. But he tells a different story about it. And then he joined. In 42, he joined the Front for the Rebirth of Poland. All sounds fine, like, you know, so he's a Polish nationalist. But they were militant and trying to undermine the German administration there, as I already said. So this, and then it says that this Front for the Rebirth of Poland was a secret Catholic social, educational, and charity organization founded by somebody with a long name. And you know that if they were calling them, everything is secret. I don't think they are able to keep all these secrets, truthfully. Because then they say, he says that from October 41, that was right after he informed this Home Army people, until 44, he studied Polish studies in the secret humanist department of Warsaw University, at the time when higher education of Poles was outlawed by the German occupational authorities. Well, you know, the Poles, I don't even mind saying this, the Poles are some of the biggest liars on the planet. They are right behind the Jews. And this guy is a Jew. He's a Pole and a Jew. And so maybe most of these Polish liars are Jewish, because there's so many Jews were always in Poland, and also there'd be so much Jewish blood mixed in with the Poles who now deny it, and just like this guy calling himself a Roman Catholic. But they lie just like the Jews do. So you can't believe what they're saying. And to think that they could have at Warsaw University, in those years that the Germans were occupying the country, that they could have a secret department and giving secret studies, secret humanist department, and people were studying Polish studies, is just it's just not really believable. They probably were allowed to do it because the Germans couldn't do everything. And I don't know about Poles being outlawed from higher education. I think that what I understand is that Poles were generally totally disloyal to the German occupation and subversive. Okay, you can say they had every right to be, but therefore they weren't trusted by the Germans, and they weren't going to help them to go to college and university and improve themselves at what they were doing. And the Germans were also trying to find cooperative Poles and part German Poles. There were those, and to get on their side, to ally with them. And that was one of the, that's something that Hasso, who the Shoah blogger writer, talked about. Well, I think it was two Saturdays ago, and that his own family, his on his father's side, his grandfather was. Family had come from Bavaria. And so the Germans were trying to get his grandfather to proclaim himself German and denounce his Polish citizenship. And he wouldn't do it. And so then they didn't help him, but they didn't treat him terribly. Now, the Germans never treated the Poles as bad as the Poles say they did. Well, that's this guy. Now, more about this Holocaust Memorial event. There's an article that I found that's kind of interesting, written by Edward Rothstein, published in the New York Times. It's kind of an editorial. And he titles it Bystanders. No, he titles it, well, okay, Bystanders Not So Innocent. And then says, some were neighbors at the, there's a big exhibit for this right now at the Holocaust Museum that's in association with this 20th anniversary, and it's titled Some Were Neighbors. So you see from all this that this is just a gigantic guilt trip for bystanders. You know, if you're a bystander, or if you have a family of these people, that everybody who did not participate in saving the Jews, you know, in a real way, is not innocent, this is just this guilt trip they're pulling. And here they speak of themselves as the national tribute, you know, And they're just trying to make all Americans accept this huge guilt that we're supposed to feel forever and ever. And this Rothstein writes about how, you know, it's going to be this weekend is the commemoration. And he says that this, he talks mostly about this exhibition, but some were neighbors, which is, here's what he says about it. It will take a visit to the new exhibition to grasp one aspect of this imposing institution's power. It reveals the demonic, not in grand forces, but in the most minute details. Yeah, another one where they find all these little things. You know, one thing they have in a photograph is some little figurines of Nazi figures. They've got three of them. I really like that photograph because I like the figurines. But, you know, supposedly if there were such a thing as figurines of National Socialists, you know, with even one has an armband around his arm and one is a soldier and one is something else, that this is demonic, shows that, you know, the minute details of how demonic everything was. So sick. And then he actually says, now, listen to this. After he talks about one woman's testimony, these are these people giving their testimonies. He talks about this one Russian woman. Then he says, I guess you can listen to these stories while you're there at the exhibit. Or listen to Stanislaw Ochman, Ochman, O-C-H-M-A-N. That's like Ox, the editor of the New York Times, similar name, who transported the Jews of his village, gives the name, in Poland. So he's Polish, and this Ox must be is a Polish name too. In a wooden wagon, or maybe it's German, in a wooden wagon to the cemetery where they were murdered. Now, we've heard this story from Jews in all these countries, and that just happened in Poland, but Romanians tell this, and there's Hungarian Jews. They're all Jews, I mean. I shouldn't say Romanians, and I shouldn't say Poles. I should say Jews who live in these countries. They tell these stories. Two, I had one, I wrote about one on Elie Wiesel Khan's The World when they were looking into those Romanian graves. That was a big farce. They had stories about a Romanian who told this. And they always tell them years later. So this goes on, Rothstein goes on, the children holding their mother's skirts were often too short for the raked gunfire, and fell into the pit still clinging as soil was piled atop them. Oh, they were clinging to their mother's skirts. Their mother was killed, but they weren't, but they fell in with her because they were too short to have the bullets hit them. And then they were, the ditch was covered. He recalled, this Ochman recalled, breathless with more than half a century of disbelief. So, yeah, he's finally telling this story half a century later. And it's a quote from him. He says, the soil was still moving because, he said, quote, they were still alive. The earth was moving. And this is what people are going to listen to, are listening to, I guess, at this exhibition at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And baloney like this, they're still saying these things. And the Holocaust Memorial Museum has no shame, and it says it represents this nation, and it puts out nonsense and backward stories, but they don't care. As I've said so many times, Jews don't care what intelligent people think as long as they can, you know, do this kind of baloney. All right, let me try to finish this here. The exhibition subtitle is Collaboration and Complicity in the Holocaust. And its focus is not on the nature, he says, it's not on the nature of Nazism or the history of anti-Semitism. He says, and it isn't as impressive as two of the museum's more ambitious recent shows about Nazi propaganda and about the perversion of Nazi medicine. And you can look up their show on the perversion of Nazi medicine, which I haven't had time to do, but, you know, just this. Nazi medicine wasn't perverted, and this whole thing is just more of these lying stories, but this is what this museum engages in. And he says, it is probably no accident that this exhibition is being mounted as the museum celebrates its 20th anniversary. By almost any measure, the institution has been an astonishing success. And he goes on to say how great the building is, the architecture of it, and so on. It actually looks like, part of it looks like a Jewish temple from back in, I don't know when. And then, at least pictures of them that they show. And then it says, tells us that the museum has had 35, this is their astonishing success, they have had 35 million visitors, about a third from schools. And despite early concerns about its focus having limited appeal, about 90% of attendees, according to the museum, are non-Jews. So, well, 90% fits with the population. And plus, you've got this forcible attendance of non-Jewish school children. A third of their 35 million. 12 million or something like that. Non-Jewish school kids have been forced to go through that and get brainwashed by that. Well, folks, this is the enemy right here. This museum, what they're doing, we can look at them, we can study them, we can see what they're doing. It's no mystery. But do we treat them as an enemy? No. Not even the much celebrated revisionists and revisionist organizations do so. They do no more than, write a few rebuttals here and there. And I'm going to continue on with that when we get back after break. And then I have some other things to talk about are very different from this. So, and you can call at that time. So stay tuned, and I will be back after this musical interlude.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. That was Moya Erdman singing Mozart's aria from Zaida, which is an unfinished opera. At one time I said it was unpublished or something, but that's not it. It's unfinished. All right, and I am Carolyn Yeager, and this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. And I was finishing up on the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and their big phony 20th anniversary, which is this weekend and on Monday. And I was pointing out, and I want to make that very clear, that, you know, as I talk about this organization and what they do, it's just like I think, boy, you know, this is the enemy. They are the enemy. And they're the enemy in the United States of America. And they're doing everything in their power to make us feel that, to make Americans feel and continue to feel that it is their duty or it is our duty I had a pretty good way of saying it, which now I don't know what it was, but I'll just say what I usually say, to make the world safe for Jews or to make us believe that genocide is a problem and we have to focus on that. It's so important, you know. Oh, that should be our main focus, because it's about humanity. And look what happened to the Jews, and we can never let it happen again. And we need to think about it and study it, and we need to make sure that it's never again and so on. And this is our responsibility. Well, I'm telling you, it's not our responsibility. It's not our responsibility to do anything for what's going on in these other countries. They always love when they get done talking about the Jewish Holocaust, they bring up Rwanda to justify them keeping this alive forever. So it's not about, it's not that we need to do anything, and we shouldn't think that we need to do anything. So it's, as I said, it's a big guilt trip, and we need to help people get off this guilt trip. And let me remind you that if you want to call now, anybody can call, and I'd be happy to get your call at 830-443-4911. Now, you know, I look to see what we're doing, and I don't want to complain about revisionist organizations who are doing something and have been around for a long time, and it's not for me to try to point the finger at them or say critical things about them. But I do think that nobody is doing enough. I mean, nobody's going after this museum except maybe Bradley Smith. You know, Bradley Smith has tried to be tough, but other people at his organization at CODO, as it has evolved, especially in recent times, don't want to do that. They're not at all tough. They're very they want to write these scholarly articles, and they want to look very respectable. They think if they're respectable, they'll get the public to pay attention to them. And if you talk like I do, then you're just going to turn people off. Well, of course, I don't agree with that. Or if I agreed with it, I would do like they do. But I don't agree with it. And I think that I have some qualification to speak about it and to speak about Holocaust revisionism. I'm not the most qualified person, but I have some qualification, and a lot of people don't have any. So all they can say is that, but that's good. They say, well, you know, it's all a big hoax, but they can't go much beyond that. So we need qualified people. We need people who can speak about it intelligently and with details and in depth here and there, you know, to come out and speak in a tougher way. You know, and I want to say also, I'm sick of hearing from Paul Eisen. I am sick of Paul Eisen being held up on some kind of throne or something, that he is such a great person because he will speak, say that he is not a believer of the traditional story of the Holocaust. So great. He's a Jew. And he's another Gilad Atzmon who is also, was hailed for that very reason. and still is, but these people do not give up their support for Jews as Jews and as for even for Israel as a nation. They just want to reform it. And as I've said before, you can't reform it. So going along and thinking you can get somewhere with these people is wrong. You're not going to get anywhere with these people. And in fact, they do damage because people are constantly being offered Paul Eisen's blogs to read, which are like this Brian guy on Clues Forum. You know, they're like going to be gatekeepers for what's really wrong, what our attitude really has to be about the Jews. And all these people who, like at Cotto now, they're afraid to offend people, as I was saying. They want to be more polite and use nicer language and so on. But they're especially afraid to offend the Jew. And many of them consider they have Jewish friends, and they consider them, you know, they're not going to attack Jews, but we have to attack Jews. We have to get rid of Jews. That's all there is to it. And I think more people need to be saying that that sounds like, well, that's it, and there's nothing more to say about it. In a way where you can keep the conversation open, but you still have to take a firm stand. Allow the conversation to be open, but take a very firm stand. That's what I would recommend to the CODO organization and other revisionists, and to IHR, Mark Weber. Now, Mark Weber is a good example of really what's really wrong with revisionism. Of course, he has left revisionism and then come back and said he never left it. Well, he's just, you know, playing around. But the bottom line is these people are not tough enough. And this is what's wrong with Mark Weber. When you go to IHR, what do you find? You find news items from the Jewish press, you know, from the mainstream, or from Jewish sources or something. And you find old articles from the 80s and 90s, or maybe around 2000, maybe up to 2005 or something. But back in that time when IHR was a going concern, which it is not now, since Mark finally dropped everything, and you find news and commentary about Israel, but you don't find any tough stance about the Jews. And either it's because that's on purpose, or he's afraid of the Jews, and he wants to keep his organization going. It is his organization now. And I looked up Vincent Renoir on IHR today, because the more I think about it, Vincent Renoir he's the one who's doing the best work, and has been for some time. He's the only one doing aggressive work in recent years, not just rehashing over the old stuff, but really, really pushing along. He's the only one I know of. And if you know of others, let me know. There's probably some that aren't as well known. But no, they're either in jail or, you know, and by the way, Gunter Deckert should be getting out very soon. I think he gets out in May, 1st of May. I'm looking forward to that. I have just not done anything with Gunter because it's just too difficult to find out anything, and also there's too much else to do, so we'll just let him rest in jail until he gets out, and then we can talk to him again. But I looked up Vincent Renoir on IHR, and the last thing I could find was 2010, some news reports about his legal difficulties, and someone was circulating a petition to support him because of his legal difficulties. And they put that up there. But that's all. No comment, you know, just posted it like a news item. No videos by Vincent Renoir, who has gone into videos big time and has been producing videos for several years. And produces, when he's really going lately, he's producing, I've gotten three new ones. So he just keeps putting out these videos. I realize they're in French, but are they making any effort? Does IHR make any effort to help Vincent with his videos, to put them in English, and to put English subtitles on them or do anything like that. They're not doing that. They don't do anything there. They do nothing. And there's no articles. Vincent also has put out some articles. He just has a new article. Again, it's in French, but, you know, it could be translated. But why don't they do it? They take in thousands and thousands of dollars a year. And it doesn't cost that much. I'm saying, you know, what does it cost to keep up the IHR? They've got a website, period. And they've got a little office, and they've got a telephone. And when you go to that website, you see these boring old articles and news items. And then you see books for sale. Now, he's had these books forever and ever, too. And he's still trying to make money off of them. I suppose he gets a new title once in a while. But you don't see anything new by him. You don't see anything, what I would like to think of a better word than aggressive. You don't see anything that's really pushing for anything. You don't see any real work going on. It's not. And so if you are sending contributions to IHR because you think they have a good website and you use the website, or you think that, or you listen to Mark Weber in his appeals that he sends out, please stop. Please stop sending contributions there, because he doesn't need all that money if he's not going to do anything. And it doesn't cost that much. It's just supporting him. It's supporting him. And you send the money to Vincent Renoir and Marie. Send money to them. They're actually working. They're actually producing things. And if they had more money, they could do more with it. We need people to turn their work into, I think they have a hard time coming up with, keeping up with people who would be helping them turn them into English, or maybe they have some other problems with that. I don't know, but I think that should be done. Anyway, I'm going to post their PayPal accounts on the program post, when I, because I don't have them handy right now, but, look to see who's doing work and send money to them. Don't send money to these same old organizations that have died a long time ago and are just staying together. That website's not going to go anywhere unless Mark Weber would decide to take it down, which that would be a nasty, nasty thing to do. So now, another thing is that the only people who can really give the Jews a run for their money is Germans. That's what I think. That's the only people who have. And as we look at the world today, of course, Germany is under a brutal legal type occupation, and people are punished there for doing anything, so they can't do much. But you still see a lot of brave Germans trying to stand up to all this. So I think that you look at Horst Mahler, Sylvia Soltz, and there are others who are doing as much as they can. But and then you see the rest of Europe. And you don't see much going on, just because they allowed themselves to be afraid of their laws that say that you can't use hate speech or something. And so they don't. And most German nations and most European nations are actually, they just cater to the Jews. They did during the war. They did afterwards. They still do. So when we talk about white Europeans standing up for what needs to be stood up for, I still say that the Germans are the ones who've actually done by far the most and will continue to do the most and are the best at it and have been most resistant to Jews of them all. So I do think we should give a leading role to Germans. Now, I was going to quote here. I'm a little lost about where I'm going with this, but okay, it, just today, this fellow Franklin Reichert, R-Y-C-K-A-E-R-T, he's familiar to a lot of people. He writes in a lot of comments and so on. And he wrote somewhere that about this about Jews, actually, I think it was about kind of in a religion between Jews and Islam or something, but he wrote some things I thought were pretty good, so I copied it down here. He says that the when Jews lose their religious faith, they switch to a secular version of their supremacist tribal ideology. Now, Franklin is from the Netherlands. That's why I thought this was interesting, because that is a Germanic, you know, considered Germanic. Holland, the Dutch, that's Deutsch, another version of Deutsch. The Dutch and the Deutsch are supposed to be so close, but the Dutch have had this anti-German. They have a history of being anti-German, where they had a lot of Jews there, you know, in Amsterdam and so on. They become very liberal, you know, and much more. The Holland or the Netherlands is much more liberal and Jew-friendly than Germany ever was, but they're such close peoples. Supposedly. I think so. I was there and I liked, I felt right at home with the Dutch, but it's in their land and everything, but it's too bad that they're so, left wingish. And, that gives a perspective from a Dutch person. And he says, that their secular version of the Jews, religion is their supremacist tribal ideology. They're destined to rule. They think they're destined to rule and exploit the whole world because they are so unique and intelligent to do so. He says, in practice, nothing will change if they lose their religion. So it's not in their religion, although there's a lot of their religion that does support it, and I would definitely say so. But he says it's just in their ethnic nature. Well, this is exactly what what the Jews accuse the Germans of doing. So again, it's one of these situations where you're pointing the finger to, of what you're putting your own, faults, seeing them in someone else. And so he says, those who say that if you give Jews a taste of their own multiculturalist medicine, they're too clever to fall. That won't work because they're too clever to fall for that. I have to agree with him on that. Some of these things that are coming up that, well, let's just turn this around on the Jews. They know better than that. He says multiculturalism is their most potent weapon to weaken and ultimately destroy us. They use it consciously. If you try to use it on them, they'll immediately recognize it for what it is. And you're not going to... Don't think that you can have them accept multiculturalism by shaming them. They have no shame. This is what a lot of these revisionists, who call themselves revisionists, but they're not, they're mostly, they've turned to being against Israel, thinking that they're going to fight the battle that way, which I don't agree with. But they think that if they point out the racist supremacists of Jews and Israeli, pro-Israeli Jews and Israeli Jews, that's going to work, you know, and then you're going to turn the tables on these people in some way. Well, you're not ever going to shame them, he says. They have ways to get around that, and they don't get shamed. They want to shame you. As I said earlier, their idea is to put this big guilt trip on us, but they're not going to fall for allowing a guilt trip to be put on them. So this is, I agree with Franklin here, that this people who are talking like this, are not seeing the picture clearly. And when you see the picture clearly, I think, at least the way that I see it, and I think I see it clearly, everybody thinks they see it clearly, I realize that, but it is a very, very bad looking picture. It is very bad looking, and there's no way to think that you're gonna bring out the best in people like Jews. You're not going to bring out, because they don't have any best. They don't really have any best. And people who are considered to be good Jews, like this Paul Eisen and Atzmon and quite a few others, they can't get past their Jewishness. They can never get past their Jewishness. And as long as they support Jews living amongst the rest of us in the world, they have to be an enemy. Because that is the enemy. That is the biggest thing that we have to be against, and that is Jews in our societies. And that's why the United States Holocaust Museum is so, you know, is the enemy. That's a part of it too, that they're here and they're promoting all this garbage and saying that they're speaking for our nation, and actually they have managed to get a mandate from the government to do this. And this is what they do. So as long as they are in our societies, and that includes people like Paul Eisen and Gilad Atzmon in the UK, and I don't know where Paul Eisen is. He might be in the UK too. But, you know, as long as they are here, it's no good. They have to go away to them, unto themselves. Then you can talk to them, and then you can deal with them. But that's the only way. Now, this thing about that so many people say that Hitler made such a mistake by being too unfriendly with the Poles, Ukrainians, the Czechs, and the Russians, and not equipping them to fight on his side, to fight against communism and the communist Soviet Union, because they all disliked it, and they would all do that, and that was his big mistake. I don't agree with that, because their thinking was, I believe, and that these did not make reliable allies. That these were not reliable allies, and they were all caught up. It's true, in their own nationalistic aims, and they would have taken advantage of what the Germans offered, and they would have tried to make themselves stronger as nations. And for those Slavic or pro-Slavic people who think that was perfectly fine, that wasn't what Germany wanted. Germany wanted to dominate this whole area, not in a slave sense or an enslavement, but it wanted to be the leading voice, and it wanted to set the tone, because it believed that two things, that it was qualified to do that, more qualified, and also that this was in the interests of Germany, and Hitler was all about what was in the interests of Germany and Germans. He never did make that big step that so many people want to attribute to him, that he suddenly became a European and he wanted to lead Europe, you know, into a whole new thing like we think about today. It wasn't like that. But I don't have time to go into that, and I don't have any preparation, but I have some other things that I want to bring in that kind of relate to that. So I will say that, you know, he's accused, and the Germans were accused, and Germans like me are accused today of saying that Slavs are inferior to Germans. But it should be put that Germans are simply superior to Slavs. It shouldn't be put in the sense of inferior, because it's not thought, well, you're inferior to me, but that Germans are better equipped to do the job that needs to be done than Slavs are. And naturally, all these people should have their own nation and national interests and so on. But they have to be done under something that's guiding everyone, that's guiding the whole thing. And history demonstrates again and again that German culture, German achievement in every realm, in every area, and Germans having so many outstanding individuals and great men and women is a fact. You know that this is the Germans are just, they are a superior people. I know that's a word. If you can think of a better word, fine. But I'm trying to be real blunt here as to some of these arguments that we get into that keep us from getting anywhere. Because they say, well, we all have to be seen as equal, and one white group, one group of white Europeans or somehow. Well, all kinds of others get involved, get connected into that. And it is simply not going to work that way, because you've got too many people with different ideas. So you've got to be united under something. And there's nothing better than the Germanic race of Europe to be united under. And there would not be, in my estimation, there would not be a mistreatment of others in the in that situation. Whereas there is a mistreatment of others when you let these Slavic nations rule or rule themselves or whatever. I want to give some example here of an article. I guess I'm not going to have any callers. I don't know why sometimes somebody calls in the beginning of the show, and but they don't call again, so I don't know who that person was, what kind of call that was. But anyway, I've got on my site now, yesterday morning, I put up the second half, the conclusion, to Willy Wenger's memoir, I'll call it, of his experience in World War II, that is called The Odyssey of Wenger, excuse me. It's a lot of people read the first part, and I hope even more will be reading this part two, and I mean continuing to read both these parts now. It's a wonderful, very valuable story of one person's experience in the war. And there's another part to this, which is his brother-in-law, Alban Lagner, which I might be able to fit in here in this program, who also had an experience, although he didn't write about it. I just have a little bit of information about him, who was also put into the battle when he was 17 and a half years old. And Willie was 18 by the time he got into battle. But this is very young, very young. And it's too bad. But, you know, the Germans were desperate, and they drafted these people. It was okay to draft someone at age 18, but they didn't get much training. And then they were thrown on these lines to help defend Berlin, basically what was going on at that time. So I want to read a part from this part two of Willy Wenger's story that I put up yesterday, which is it's not very nice. Maybe it's his experience in the Czech Republic. It's his experience when he was ran into the Czechs on trying to get back home to Austria. So, but this it fits with so much that we have that we know from elsewhere. I mean, we know all this. And I know that this is the real experience of Willie, because he's a very honest person. And Hadding came on the line. Hi, Hadding. Hi. Well, I was just going to read something about Willie, but if you want to go ahead and give us your what you have to say here.
Yeah. Well, I was going to comment. You said that you didn't really believe that Polish universities were shut down during the Second World War by the Germans. I was just doing a little research on that.
But now let me just say that I didn't say I didn't believe they were shut down, but I had never heard about that. And then I said that if the Poles were not cooperating with the German occupation, they wouldn't be wanting them to go to universities. But anyway, so go ahead.
Well, you seem to be in doubt about it, and yeah, it's reasonable to be in doubt about it, since there's so many wacky claims out there. But you can go to the website of the University of Warsaw, and it says that they were shut down during the war. However, if you look in the larger context, it's not that shocking, because I'm looking right here at an article from the Miami News, 2nd of December, 1939, and it says that in Germany, came war, lights were switched off in most German universities, with only half a dozen now open, such famed institutions as Heidelberg and Freiburg are gathering cobwebs. Medical students, 'tis said, are pinched diagnosing for surgeons sent to the front. But instructions in chemistry instruction in chemistry and engineering marches on at double quick. So German universities also, for the most part, were shut down.
What was the year of that? When did they turn off the lights?
This report is from December 1939. It says that when the war started in September 1939, the lights went off in most German universities.
Well, they had blackouts starting then.
What they mean is instruction.
I know, but I'm just saying, I wonder if that has anything to do. Are you saying no, that has nothing to do with saying that they couldn't stay open?
It's nothing to do with bombing. What it means is that they took the manpower and put it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
They had a more immediate priority for the resources involved.
Right. Okay, so, well, that's a very good point. Now, you know, back to the... So what should we think about them saying, well, the Germans shut down the Polish universities in Warsaw? Well, how many places did they have universities? Only in a few big cities.
Well, there was Warsaw and Krakow, and I'm not sure where else. But another factor in it is the fact that universities were great centers of political agitation. Some of the anti-German rallies before the war were at universities in Poland.
Well, sure they were, and that's what it was saying here. That it was saying that he was doing all this amongst these academic class and these organizations that they had, and they're calling them secret. They're saying, oh, they continued on, that there was a secret classes at the University of Warsaw. Let's see, what did he call that?
Yeah, a clandestine University of Warsaw.
Yeah.
That's on the University of Warsaw's website. I'm not sure really how clandestine they had to be. The Germans just probably just wanted the resources involved used for something else.
Well, and they wouldn't want all these Poles to be going to university and studying how to be better, not just agitators, but opponents to themselves.
Yeah.
So they didn't want this whole Polish culture, anti-German Polish culture, to be continued. So, I just think that there probably are saying this in words that give somewhat the wrong impression. Do you think so?
Well, sure. They didn't do it just because they were hostile to higher education or anything like that.
For Poles, yeah. Now, they were supposed to, what they want to intimate here is that the Poles were supposed to be a slave class now, and so they couldn't go to university. But that's not it, and they'd never...
Well, a lot of Germans couldn't go to university either, so...
That's right, and they didn't intend for Poles or any of these people to be a slave class. How would you put it? I mean, what do you think of what I was saying there about the only Germans can give the Jews a run for their money, and the Germanic nations, are particularly led by Germany, should be the dominating nation, or you might say the dominating people of Europe in Eastern Europe. That's going to upset a lot of people, but your opinion.
The Germans seem to be the only nation of any size that has both the intelligence and the cohesion and the tenacity to resist the Jews successfully.
Well said. Well said, Hattie. yes, and also to lead the European people, white people, into a good kind of a unity where they stay strong. I think they're also that's also true for the Germans. I went way out, and I said it's not the Germans are superior to the Slavs, but I think I just get where I just want to be honest, and I want to say what I think is true. And all this German bashing that goes on, and all these people saying, oh, Hitler's big mistake was he alienated the Slavs. I don't know how you were. The Slavs had been alienated to the Germans for a long time already.
Well, Germany had some Slavic allies in the war. Bulgaria was allied with Germany. Mm-hmm. Yugoslavia was, for a very short time, allied with Germany until its government was overthrown by the UK and the Soviet Union. Germany, you know, Slovakia was allied with Germany.
Right.
You know, many
so
of
there
the...
You go. So that this is the point I wanted to make, actually, which I didn't get to. And that is that the biggest, most difficult people of Eastern Europeans are the Poles and the Czechs. They are the most difficult people. They have this strong sense that they should be seen as a greater people, where these others are, yeah, you're right. These others were much more agreeable to Germany and with Germany. So while they don't, they have Romanians had a strong nationalist movement, but it wasn't in the same, it was German friendly.
Yeah, well, Romanians aren't really Slavs, but yeah, there were a number of Eastern European, especially Balkan allies for Germany.
Yeah, but then...
And Hitler would have liked to have had more.
Yes, he would have. He wanted to make the Poles allies, but they were allied to England and the U.S., and they were not going to ally with Germany. That seems to me that was their mistake. They're the ones who made the mistake.
The Poles seem to have an overinflated sense of their importance in the world after they defeated the Soviet Union in the early 1920s.
That's right. They won a battle, or, you know, they won that thing. Something caused that to happen. And that may be where it started, where they started thinking that they were greater than they are.
And that they really cut their own nose off, as it were, to spite their face by not cooperating with Hitler.
Well, they did. They're the ones who made the mistake. The Poles made the mistake, and the Germans had to live with it and deal with it. And they kept, you know, they would have liked to have, they were trying to turn the Czechs into allies, and they never mistreated the Czechs. Never. But the Czechs wanted to make out like they did, and the only thing they could point to is that Lidice, know, where after they assassinated the great Reinhard Heydrich. So, you know, again, I was going to read something here about the Czechs. You want to stay on and listen while I read it and comment?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, the British instigated that assassination of Heydrich specifically.
Well,
they did it specifically to sour relations between the Germans and the Czechs, because actually the Czechs were getting along very well under German, German protection, I guess you could say.
Well, that's exactly right. And I've said that too, and I've written that, and that's absolutely without a doubt the truth. And the Germans were put in a very impossible situation where they had to react, do something. And they did that Lidice thing. And even that Lidice thing has been exaggerated beyond what it was. So there's never any truth. And I'm sick of all the lies and the untruth. And I'm going to say the truth as I see it to be, and not worry about how it affects other people, because they're not, as far as I'm concerned, they're not telling the truth. So this is what Willy Wenger wrote as he was, you know, the war was over. He was trying not to be arrested here or there. He's trying to get back from basically from Berlin, north of Berlin to his home in Austria without getting picked up. He was in the Soviet zone of Germany at this time. It was probably late June or is in July already. Anyway, he was with a small group of people at that point, and they were still in Germany, Soviet-controlled Germany. But he was dressed as a civilian. He had gotten civilian clothing earlier, and he had gotten rid of all his military papers and everything, and he had some kind of a pass that he got from a town up north. So he says, someone suggested to try a steamship trip. We saw a boat on a landing stage and manned there at the Elbe River and managed to get on board and amid a hard-pushing crowd. In the distance, we recognized the silhouettes of Dresden, and by the dimming light of the early evening, we made out the contours of some of the well-known buildings. How terrible then was the view when we approached the waterfront. Not one house or building was intact. It was ruins everywhere and piles of rubbish, a depressing scene of devastation. We lost our orientation because former streets were narrowed to paths of small roads, edged on both sides by piles of stones, wood, and wire, We hurried along and just guessed our direction towards the south. We were now a small group of Austrians. They were, you know, they had learned that it was, he had learned earlier that it was no longer Ostmark. It was Austria again. Closely bound together by our decision to make our way to Austria through the former protectorate Bohemia, Moravia. It was now the new Czech Republic, and we were uncertain what was waiting for us there. We were hungry and tired when we boarded the overloaded train, and in a while crossed the border. We noticed that the Czech passengers looked at us with deep suspicion. We were all wearing red, white, red patches on our jackets and held on to our papers identifying us as Austrians. When we could not answer their questions in Czech, most of them addressed us in German. A flood of terrible tales poured over us. They were eager to let us know how they treated German civilians, their neighbors, and German soldiers without their weapons. They demanded our attention as to how they threw people into the Elbe River, nailed them on rafts and burned them, burned German soldiers alive after they clobbered them to cripples. Deeply shocked, we were quiet, did not utter a word, and were relieved when we arrived at Litomeritz, or Leitmeritz in German, and had to get off the train. Now they were now in Czechoslovakia, in Czech Republic, I believe, when they got off. We were directed to a freight train and told it was on the way to Vienna. The cars were dirty and full of coal dust. I got very suspicious, and sure enough, after the train left, somebody yelled, "It is going to Poland!" When the train slowed, climbing up a hill, I and a friend from my home area, Brooke, jumped off the train. It was pitch dark. I rolled down a hill, did not hurt myself, and found my comrade also unhurt. We walked back to the train station and in the morning boarded a train to Prague. That was sheer luck. At Prague, we had to leave the train again and found out that in a few hours a train will depart for Vienna. We walked through the city and were surprised to see streets and houses intact, no ruins at all, and plenty of goods in the stores, like a fairy tale. But it did not help us. Hungry, we returned to the station. Terrified, we recognized that the entrance was cordoned off by military police and everybody was checked. I had lots of trouble convincing them that I was an Austrian returning from work in Germany and not a Hitler youth or soldier. My papers with the stamps and signatures were finally a help to me. They turned my rucksack upside down, but luckily my watch that was hidden there did not fall out. My comrade from Brook also passed. We found the train to Bruin, but we did not find any room inside, and so climbed, like many others, onto the roof. Now, Bruin was involved in a lot of war crimes against Germans right at the surrender, from the surrender time onward. So he said they were on this train to Bruin. There we did not have to listen to the horrible talk, but we got some bruises. Well, there's a story about him sitting there with a Russian soldier with his Kalashnikov, and how this Russian was real friendly to Willie and his friend, but he didn't like the Czechs. And when the train stopped at a station for a stop, he said he handed his Kalashnikov to Willie and said, "Take care of this for me. I'm going to get a drink of water." And he left him with it, and he went down and Willie said, "The Czechs looked hatefully at me, and I was afraid something might happen." But soon the soldier returned and sat down as if nothing had happened. He wondered if he wanted to humiliate the Czechs. But this is an important part. During the afternoon, we arrived at the central station of Brünn. I tried to join a line in front of a Red Cross station to get something to eat. Hateful voices yelled at me, "Deutsche raus!" That is, "Get out, you Germans!" They pushed me away and threatened me. A Red Cross nurse grabbed my hand and gave me a bowl of soup and a slice of bread. Never did a meal taste better. And then I had a little more here, but I don't need to read it, where they finally got to the border and they laid there, spent the night until in the morning they could cross the border, and he was back home again. But this was the way, this is the way, you know, this is the way the Czechs can be, and I don't think there's any question about it that you wouldn't have had Germans treating Czechs in this way, but you did have Czechs treating Germans in this way when they got the upper hand. And a lot of these, now, when you talk about the ones who are doing a lot of the persecution and killing and so on, Well, that was encouraged by the communists and the Jews, although in Czechoslovakia wasn't so many Jews. In Poland, there was a lot of Jews. But the people themselves tended to want to kick the Germans out and then not give them a damn thing. And they didn't have any pity whatsoever. And I think they probably felt like they couldn't afford to have any. And they wanted to get everything back again. And so this is the way they behave. So, you know, to talk about German behavior toward the Slavs doesn't take into account this Slavic behavior toward Germans, which is becoming, at least more and more people are learning about it, but it's certainly never given any space in the mainstream. So any comment on that?
Yeah, I think the reason why we tend to have an exaggerated view of this question, or a distorted view, is that we in the United States tend to think of everything in politics in terms of abstract principles. That's not the way National Socialists looked at these things. The idea that the Germans or Germanic people in general were somewhat superior to Slavs in general, it came from Gobineau and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, you know, who were well respected when they presented their ideas. I know George Bernard Shaw was a fan of Chamberlain, and it doesn't mean that from a National Socialist perspective, being pro-German does not necessitate being anti-everybody else. Because the idea was that it was necessary for Germany to have what Germany would need to survive. It's also necessary to do things in a way that was commensurate with the German sensibility. So they really couldn't do all kinds of crazy stuff such as is portrayed in American World War II propaganda. The idea that the Germans were going to wipe out any entire nation by killing all of them is just crazy. The idea that Germans would go along with that is just crazy. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't do any more than they would have to do to ensure their survival as a nation. And that's all that Hitler had in mind.
Well, very good. And then, you know, that's very well said, Hattie. I really appreciate it. Willy Wenger had told me, and I've got some material written about him, which I'm going to post it sometime if I can figure out quite where or how. His brother-in-law, his wife's brother, she comes from a large family, and there are a lot of children, and one of them was this Alvin Lagner, who was working as a waiter when he was still only 17. And he then was drafted at 17 and a half, and he wouldn't have been 18 until I don't have the right page up here, but until May 45, I think he was 18. So he wasn't even 18. And he was put on the Czech border near Cottbus in an armored unit, and he was seriously wounded in March, and he lost his left arm, and he had several operations on it in Cottbus. But Cottbus was controlled by the Germans, but then it says he was in Czech captivity. I guess later he was probably a hospital patient. Anyway, he got captured by the Czechs. It doesn't say when here, but on May 9th, he was a prisoner of the Czechs. And on the final day of German capitulation, the truce was declared, and all the crippled and wounded that the Czechs had in their control, the Germans, were taken to this road. And we've seen film now of a lot of this, and there's a lot of this going on. taken to the road and had to lie down and couldn't get away or anything, and they brought tanks to run over them. And they were running over them with tanks. And it says, had not an old woman had the courage and compassion to pull Alban out from there, away from the path there of the tanks, he would have been killed by that. But he had also gotten wounded in the right foot, so he could hardly walk. And he had this arm missing. And he found there was this other guy from where his area in Austria, and he befriended him, and they were still prisoners, you know, and in a camp of some kind, and they were this Anton Zraunig from Austria was helping him out, and one day they managed to just walk away from there, and get on their way home, and it took them a long time because Alban couldn't really walk very well. And this other fellow had to carry him when they were going over rough terrain. And he just stayed with him till they got all the way home. And eventually, Alban had to have his leg amputated above the knee because of that foot wound and all that time that he was walking on it and so on. And he was just he was just a horrible mess. I don't know how he did it. I really don't know. But this poor guy, he sure suffered. And he was, of course, able to go back and be a waiter again, which is what he always wanted to do. But he never married, and he got to know a woman who took care of his wounds. And this Anton Zraunig was always his good friend, and his family cared for him and so on. But, you know, he had a missing arm and a missing leg from all of that, and he didn't accomplish a damn thing either. So you can get kind of mad at the German military, the way they are throwing these kids trying in this big effort to defend Berlin, which didn't succeed. But what do you have to say about that? Anything?
Well, I don't know. That was a very desperate situation. I think it's hard to know what anybody would do in that kind of a situation.
Well, yes. And, you know, he was just an unlucky one. Now here, Willy Wenger, he was at the Seelo Heights battle. That huge battle, and he writes about it, and it's just unbelievable, you know. He wasn't accomplishing anything there either. I mean, his being there really didn't, you know, he managed to do a few decent things, but he mostly was trying to survive, and he took three or four months, and he went from being sent up, you know, started out there in Berlin as a soldier. He was supposed to be in the Air Force, but they moved all these Air Force cadets into the front line, you know, as a, I don't know what they were, parachute troopers or something. But he managed all that time, and he got home all intact. He had some wounds too, but he recovered from them. And they weren't real that serious. And, but this poor Alban, he lost an arm and a leg. And so some people, you know, it's luck. It really is luck. What else can it be unless you believe in some kind of destiny? But.
Yeah, I think if you want to talk about the morality of decisions in wartime, one of the most immoral decisions was for the entry of the United States of America into the war. And just look at the way D-Day was accomplished through human waves going into machine gun fire.
Yes.
You know, this was just slaughter by the United
Yes.
States government. Of their own men in order to overthrow a government with which the American people had no essential quarrel.
Well, that's right. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I did mention a few shows back that this Eisenhower's plan for D-Day was very damaging to, you know, to so much, brought so much troops death. And that's why they wanted to use the A-bomb, partly in Japan, in order to bring the war to a close so they weren't going to sacrifice any more American lives and make the numbers even worse, so that the American people would be unhappy with the way they waged the war. Because in the end, it's all political decisions.
Right? Yeah, well, I'm persuaded by that half-Jew film director's documentary, the argument that he makes that actually it was the USSR's advances in Manchuria that persuaded the Japanese to end the war. Not the bombing of civilians by
Well, yeah, and I read that last week too, or was it Monday? I don't know if you don't always listen, Oh, you never listen. but that I was talking about the Japanese, the way it went with the Japanese, and they said themselves that the emperor, that when it was one thing to be fearing another bomb, but another thing for the USSR to have declared war and was now in the process of invading them. That's what scared the heck out of him, and he wasn't going to. He knew he couldn't deal with that. And if Japan refused to attack the USSR themselves when they were stronger, and that's what hurt Hitler so much, because Hitler expected that the USSR would be at war on two fronts too, and they weren't.
Yeah.
Because of the failure of the Japanese. So I always say that the Allies, Germany's allies, never came up to the mark, but Britain's allies, United States and Russia, did. You know.
Well, actually, Britain actually sacrificed a whole lot in order to win that war. They lost their empire.
Well, yeah, you know,
planes produced in Britain, instead of being sent to defend Singapore, they were sent to the Soviet Union.
That's right. It's all those stories. Well, we could cover a lot of that stuff sometime. We're finished with the show though, and I want to thank. Are we? I think so. Yeah. I want to thank you, Hadding, for calling in. You made a lot of interesting points here for sure. And I want to thank you, listeners, for sticking with the program. It turned out I had quite a lot of listeners, and I'm pleased with that. So come back next week and also listen to our shows at the White Network during the week. And enjoy the Polish composer Chopin's music. It's almost over when the month is over, so we've got him streaming live. Tan picked that out on our streaming radio. So good night, everyone. I mean, goodbye.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.